a senior scientist at the Sunnybrook Research Institute. She is also an associate professor at the Department of Medical Biophysics at University of Toronto. And her research interests including focus on major issues in medical image analysis. And she and her research group focus on developing novel image analysis techniques in solving problems such as computer-aided disease detection and diagnosis, and also assessment of disease severity and assessment on the monitoring the patient response to different therapies. So I'll give you Dr. Mattel.
So first of all, thank you to Adrian for inviting me to this very interesting meeting. And also disclosure, I'm not a mathematician, so you'll find that the emphasis goes from formulae to images in this talk very much so. So I'm going to talk to you today about the work my group are doing on the assessment of therapeutic response using dynamic contrast enhanced MRI. Can you hear me at the back? Yeah, okay. So in cancer, just to give you a quick start on some cancer biology. We all know that cancer cells are different to normal cells in the body and that they have several differences. They tend to divide too quickly. They also don't respond to the normal signals that make cells die, so they no longer respond to programmed cell death signals. So what happens in the body is that cancer cells will start to grow, they'll start to multiply, and eventually they'll get to a point where they need to create a new blood supply because they can't get enough oxygen anymore. So they tend to send out new signals that create the new blood vessels here, angiogenesis, this process is called. And eventually you get a large tumor that's well vascularized, filled with multiplying cancer cells. Now the conventional therapy for cancer has always been to try and kill off these cancer cells without destroying all the normal cells in the body. So the idea is that radiotherapy, chemotherapy, you try and knock down all the rapidly dividing cells and you try and spare all the normal cells that are dividing less rapidly, hence all the radiotherapy and chemotherapy type protocols. So when you've, this is an example of what radiotherapy looks like when it's applied to a tumor in a mouse flank. So this area of dense purple here is actually the tumor. This bright pink is the muscle. And you can see in the center here, there's a lighter area. And when we stain it with a different staining agent that marks for apoptosis, you can see that the radiotherapy has killed off the core of this tumor. It's gone necrotic. So what happens then is the body starts to clean up all those dead cells, and the tumor starts to shrink. And it's this shrinkage of a tumor that's formed the basis of most tumor therapy assessment in the past number of years. So if you're going into a cancer trial looking at a new drug therapy, the standard protocol will be that you'll go for imaging at the beginning of the treatment, and someone will measure the size of the tumor. So the standard thing that's been around for years is called the RECIST criteria, and it's extraordinarily simple. You just find your tumor. This is a tumor in the lung here. This is a chest CT scan. So you find your tumor, you find the longest axis in any dimension in the tumor, and you record its length, and that's basically your marker of tumor size. I mean, the World Health Organization suggested that, well, maybe we could go for the two axes and maybe get some measure of area, but it really is that basic. And the idea is that as the tumor is treated, then the cells are removed as they die, and the tumor should ideally shrink. So this is one taken from a book here. This is an ideal case. This is an MRI of a breast tumor. This is a MIP image through the breast tumor. So you can see before therapy, this thing measured 47 millimeters. And then post-chemotherapy here, it measures 16 millimeters. So in this case, we've been able to demonstrate a therapeutic response to chemotherapy. But the problem with using these very basic measures is it takes some time for the tumor to actually shrink. So we may want to know what the effects of therapy are much sooner than after several weeks or even months. I think this is at least a month they have to do this. New therapy agents are much more expensive, so we really want to know, are they responding quicker than that? And therapy these days isn't just based on radiotherapy and the idea of just killing off rapidly dividing cells. It's much more specific than that. So these are scanning electron microscopes of vasculature. These are ex vivo images formed from Cas. So you can see the normal vasculature in the tissue is very well structured. You can see the vessels are fairly smooth, they're well connected. There's an efficient network to get blood from the arteries into the veins and through the capillaries to the tissue. when we have a tumor, although the cancer cells signal to create new blood vessels, these new blood vessels aren't really very good compared to the normal blood vessels. You can see there's lots of dead ends, the branching network is chaotic, it's very fragmented. So the idea with new therapies is that instead of trying to target the cells, we try and target things like the vasculature. We have anti-angiogenic therapies, for example. We try and prevent new vessels from forming, or we destroy the vessels that have already formed, and the idea is to starve the cancer of oxygen so it dies off. So this means that we don't just want to know about tumor size anymore when we're doing our assessment of therapeutic response. We want to know things like angiogenesis. Are these cells dying of their own accord? We may have some agent that's supposed to promote that. Angiogenesis is vessels, apoptosis is are the cells dying. What have we done to the oxygen concentration in the tumor, for example? Even gene expression may be an area that we need to look at. So the traditional CT probably gives us some idea of tumor size. If we get fancy, some of the newer research centers are looking at angiogenesis using CT. But to look at things like apoptosis, maybe ultrasound techniques, again, we can look at morphology. We can use contrast-enhanced ultrasound with microbubbles to start looking at perfusion. And also there's newer work on tissue characterization using radiofrequency information. Optical spectroscopy can give us a handle on some of these things. And PET, of course, helps give us the molecular imaging part of this, looking at gene expression and so on. But this talk's going to be concentrating on magnetic resonance imaging, partly because it's much more flexible than the other techniques. We can pretty much get a whole range of different measures from one imaging visit. It's also something that's available in most large centers these days, and it's becoming cheaper relative to some of the other techniques as the technology is becoming more available. So we can get morphology, perfusion, we can get some idea of other parameters such as diffusion, and newer techniques that use things like hyperpolarized contrast agents can even start to do spectroscopy. So for this talk, I'm actually going to concentrate on perfusion dynamic contrast enhanced imaging using MRI. So what is this? This on here, as you can see it very well, is a perfusion run through a patient's abdomen. And this patient has a large renal cancer. You can see the contrast agent arrives in the vessels, perfuses the kidney, and then starts to concentrate in there. I'm not sure if we can get the lights down a little bit to see some of these images, actually. That might be useful. But for now, you can see that what happens is that we can track the change in concentration of contrast agent through time at any point in the image. And this gives us information about how leaky the blood vessels are, how well perfused the tumor is, and so on. And we can extract quantitative information from these images. So the simple way of doing it is just to plot signal intensity over time and then just get some heuristic metrics, like how much is the enhancement, how much is the washout. This gives us some idea of how much blood is getting to the tumor, and this can give us some idea of how leaky the blood vessels are, and so on. But a more sophisticated way of doing it is probably more accurate is to use pharmacokinetic modeling. I'm only going to go into this briefly now, but there are a couple of talks later in the dynamic imaging session which will probably go into more detail. But this typical pharmacokinetic model is that we have contrast agent mixing in the blood plasma, so this is the intravascular compartment here, CP, and then it can exchange with the extracellular extravascular space, and we can measure these rate constants if we know what the concentration is in the EES and in the CP, so we can just form these differential equations here. Slightly more complicated because we can't actually measure the EES, we have to measure the tissue compartment. So we get some different rate constants here. We get what's called KEP, which is taking into account the fraction of the space occupied by tissue and extracellular extravascular space. And we also get what's called K-trans, which is this rate constant here. So these two parameters are frequently derived from these differential equations here. So the idea is you measure your tissue contrast concentration, your intravascular contrast concentration, and you fit this to some sort of curve. It shows you how to do it in practice. So here is where we'd get something like the intravascular concentration from. So this is a region of interest over the arteries here. This is a prostate image. So what you can see here is the prostate. This is where the probe is in the rectum. So if you draw a region of interest over the prostate, you can get a curve there. If you change the region of interest, you get a slightly different curve. And the idea is that we just use this information here to get hold of these rate constants. So just to show how this might be useful, this is a contrast-enhanced image of the breast here. Ignore the stripes. These are due to undersampling artifacts. This is from Don Pluis's lab, and I think Rachel Chan actually produced these images using a radial sampling technique. So what we've got here is contrast agent flooding into this large, locally advanced breast tumor here. And we've done some pharmacokinetic modeling and fitted K-trans and VE maps. So you can actually do this on a pixel-by-pixel basis over the whole breast. And what this helps you to do is see where the inhomogeneities are. So you can see here that the K-trans is somewhat non-uniform, and the VE as well, and they're actually giving you slightly different information. Sorry. So dark, I can't even see my own buttons here. So what I'm going to do in this talk today is go through some of the areas of challenge to do this. So the idea of using pharmacokinetic models isn't new in contrast-enhanced imaging or in therapeutic assessment, but there are various areas where we need further work. So I'm not going to talk about the image acquisition or the quantitative imaging where we try and actually match the signal intensity to real quantities such as the concentration of gadolinium DTPA. And hopefully Margaret Cheng will be talking about some of that in the dynamic imaging session this afternoon. But I will be talking about some work our group's doing in image registration, in model fitting, and in validation to try and improve our assessment of therapeutic response. So starting off on image registration, you've just heard a little bit about that. So we start off with the problem we want to match our template image to our reference image. So the standard procedure is we get some sort of objective function, so we calculate a distance measure. And this tells us after we've transformed our template image by some deformation y, we want to see how close it becomes to our reference image. This measure here could be something like mutual information, sum of squares difference, even an L1 norm or something like that. But the idea is that this tells us how close our warped image is to our reference image. And then because this is an ill-posed problem, we then have to add a regularization field onto the deformation field here. Okay, so this is the regularization of the deformation field. We're using a FAIR toolkit by Jan Matuszewski. He was at Hamilton for a brief time and is now in Germany, but we're doing some collaboration with him. And this toolkit is in MATLAB, so it's a very flexible way of testing different algorithms. Now, the problem with this is, sorry, there's an awful lot of these images here. The problem with this is that image registration is hard in dynamic contrast enhanced imaging. So you've heard in the previous speakers talking about how you use image registration to match one patient's data into the space represented by another patient's data. So there you're trying to warp structures into a common space. Well, in contrast-enhanced DCMRI, this is a set of images. This is one single scan through a patient's abdomen. So each of these represents a different slice through the body. These are coronal slices here. And you see it changing in time. So this should all go dark, and then you should see the contrast coming down the aorta and then flooding into the abdomen. Now, let's see if I can get that going again. Now, so this is the start of it here, and then you're going to see the contrast agent coming in. And what you'll see is that the images change completely through the course of this study. Now, the problem is that existing image registration techniques are trying to make one image in the sequence identical to a previous image in the sequence. So for example, here we've got a pre-contrast image and a post-contrast image. So existing registration techniques are trying to match these two up. And if we just use a difference metric to drive that registration, we're going to have problems because there are changes here because of motion and because of contrast enhancement. So this is the absolute difference between those two images. We can see that there are changes because of misregistration. So these edges here are due to motion. But most of the changes are actually due to contrast enhancement. So if we attempt to minimize the difference here or minimize this metric here, for example, what's going to happen is that the deformation that we're going to calculate, even if we do try and regularize it, it's going to try and shrink this thing so that it minimizes the differences over here, for example, because it's bright around here. This is bright, so it's going to try and push all this bright tissue into this area here. We're going to end up shrinking the kidney. This is clearly hopeless. We can't use this kind of approach for DCMRI. So my group's been taking a couple of approaches. The first one is just simply to change this image here, the template image, so that it looks more like the reference image, so that when we calculate this distance metric here, it's less affected by that change. Okay, so this method has been used by Anthony Lausch, a master's student in my lab. So this is the template image and the reference image here. So the idea is we want this image to look more like this image. And what Anthony's done is he's taken the difference between these two images here, and he's just blurred it out. So ideally, if these two images were perfectly aligned, then the difference image would just be the contrast enhancement. Okay, and this is the worst possible case, one of the worst possible cases is pre and post contrast enhancement in this renal tumor here. So ideally, this would just represent contrast enhancement, but in practice, we've also got motion in here. So he blurs it with a Gaussian kernel related to the amount of motion we expect, and then adds this back to our template image to give us a modified image here. And the idea is that this looks much more like this. So when you calculate the absolute difference here, we find much more information to do with the edges and much less information to do with the contrast enhancement. And this helps to stabilize our image registration algorithm. So this is an example of after registration. And hopefully you'll see, I forgot to point out actually on the previous image that it was moving up and down a lot because of motion from the diaphragm. But hopefully you can see now that we've taken away most of that breathing motion and cardiac motion. We've actually got a very steady image here. This makes much more difference when you're dealing with standard analysis of DCMRI is to draw a region of interest around your tumor and then to do that parametric modeling and so on. So if you're taking a region of interest curve around this tumor here, you can see the problem before registration. You can see that the actual tissue is moving in and out of the region of interest. Now, if you're trying to measure therapeutic response, you might want to look at local therapeutic response, but you clearly can't do a pixel-by-pixel analysis here because the stuff's moving too much. If you're trying to pick a region of interest, it gets difficult because do you make the region of interest small to keep away from these moving structures, or do you try and include as much as you can? If you look after registration, you can hopefully see that this is actually not moving anywhere near so much. If you look at where the tumor is now, that region of interest is staying in the same place. This region was based on this region here, so it's not quite perfect for what you'd normally draw, but it shows you the idea that this is no longer moving in and out. So by changing our template image so it looks more like our reference image, we can attempt to help with the registration process. And this shows you what happens with the pharmacokinetic map. So this is a VE map. So this is from that case there, before image registration on a sub-region basis. You can see a map here. This is just the original image, just to give it some idea of where you are. So this is the edge of the tumor here. And you can see after registration, we get rid of some of these areas of high VE, which are probably artifacts due to the fact this border's moving in and out of the field of view. So this works quite well in this particular case, but it is somewhat heuristic and may not be ideal for all applications. So Marin Abrahimi in my lab is working on a more rigorous technique. So what he's doing is instead of trying to match the template image to the reference image, he's trying to match the template image and a contrast enhancement term to the reference image. So here we're assuming that what we're looking at is an image that should be identical to the reference image, except for the fact it's got this contrast term added to it. Okay. So W is our contrast enhancement term, U is the deformation. So the idea is you find a deformation and a contrast enhancement term, which helps us to minimize this function here. So now the distance measure doesn't get affected anywhere near so much by the contrast agent. So in actual fact, even a simple L2 norm will be quite reasonable for trying to do this image registration, which has other advantages in terms of speed. Of course, now we have to regularize both our displacement field and our contrast enhancement term. So that's where Maran's work is going to come into. And he's talking more about his registration work tomorrow in the industrial application session tomorrow afternoon. But this shows you the same example as I showed you earlier. But now Maran is trying to estimate the contrast term at the same time as the displacement field. So you can see we get a much more stable looking solution here for our displacement. This is our transformed template, and this is now the difference between the registered image and the transformed image, which is basically our contrast enhancement term. So you can see now we've done much less deformation of our structures in order to preserve that contrast. So that's the image registration side of things. Now I'm going to move on to model fitting. And talk about the problem of MRI in that for the pharmacokinetic modeling, if you remember, I said we needed to have both the concentration of contrast agent in the tissue component and in the extravascular plasma component here. So we need to be able to measure both of these in order to estimate K-trans and KEP. The problem is this is a DCE MRI image taken over, an animal tumor. So it's quite blurry. So what you can see is contrast agent going in and spreading around and coming out again. You can see it's very poor resolution. There's no way we can actually find a region of interest that represents pure plasma and tissue without plasma. So the way around this normally is to try and find a remote vessel So somewhere in the field of view, you'll try and find a blood vessel that's big enough to do a region of interest. And then you might model an extra term in here to take into account the fact that this term here is probably contaminated with some fraction of intravascular activity as well. Now, contrast-enhanced ultrasound doesn't have this problem. This is a contrast-enhanced ultrasound of the same tumor in the same position. And this is work done in Rajiv Chopra's lab by Chaitanya, one of his postdocs. And he's made a rig where you can actually show the same tumor with ultrasound as you can with MRI. So he does the ultrasound first, injects a contrast agent, and then puts the animal in the MRI scan and does the same thing. Now, the contrast agent we use in ultrasound is much bigger than the one in MRI, so it can't leak out through the vasculature. It stays in the plasma component, basically. So this is giving us what ideally we want for this CP here. And Rajiv's interest is actually in using this in pharmacokinetic modeling as the CP. But what we wanted in my group was, can we actually estimate from here, can we extract out this and the tissue compartment directly using a data-driven method? So I'm not going to go into this too much detail because this is a mathematical audience, so you all know what a general linear model is. But just to show how it slightly differs from the normal way of thinking about it. So this is a cartoon study here, 30 images taken over time. And if you imagine contrast agent appears in this item here, and then moves into this component here, and then carries on through time. So we can think of any image in this sequence as being made up of a linear combination of these three component images. We can also think of any signal intensity curve. So say I take a point here, then the signal intensity curve is going to be a flat line. If I take a point here, then the signal intensity curve is going to be a linear combination of these three curves here. So we can think of this either as a linear combination of three component curves or three component images. It doesn't really matter which way around we choose it if there's just Gaussian noise in there. So our data matrix D is basically a linear combination of F, our factor curves, and A, our factor images or component images. Now, PCA is the standard way of doing this. I've just done a quick cartoon to demonstrate what's going to happen here. So these are our two components here. We've got a fish out of water and the Arizona desert. And we've got two different mixtures. So these would be equivalent to our two dynamic images, and we're trying to get back out to our two pure components here. So in PCA, what we're trying to do is maximize the covariance. So if we take the histogram through a projection image here, so this is just a projection along one axis. This is one of our component images. We're trying to maximize the variance that's represented by that image. So as we rotate that axis there, we can see that we're improving the standard deviation. And at some point, we're going to maximize that to get our principal component image. Once we've done it for one, then we can get the orthogonal component for the second. But you see, the problem with principal components analysis, although it's very good for things like shape modeling and reducing dimensionality, it's not great if you actually want the components to be physically meaningful. These are statistically derived. They have no physical meaning. And you can see we've got fish and desert in both of these images, which isn't really what we want. Turns out the ICA does a much better job. ICA isn't trying to maximize the variance. It's trying to make the probability distribution as non-Gaussian as possible. So again, if we take a projection image here, this is the projection histogram here. And we've got the kurtosis value, which is a surrogate measure of Gaussianity here. And a simple ICA algorithm will simply just try and maximize the kurtosis here. You can see pretty quickly in just a few iterations, we've got up to one of our component images, which is exactly what we want, is a pure component from the data. In this case, we've only got two images, so the next image is going to be orthogonal to that. It's going to give us this. By the way, this was a pre-Whiting data matrix in this case, which is why we've got this square distribution here. So ICA is quite powerful when we apply it to medical image data of this kind. It's difficult to control, and there's lots of parameters to set, but it can give us very good results. So this, going back to this DCMRI study of the breast that we had earlier, if I apply ICA to this and just take four components, so this is using fast ICA, it does a PCA analysis first, and then you extract the same number of ICA, so I've just used four components here. You can see that we actually get things that look quite physiologically meaningful here. And if I compare this to the 2K trans maps that we had earlier, the two parametric maps we had earlier, this is the K-trans, this is the VE here. You see that this component actually looks rather like the K-trans map. It's not dissimilar. And the curve has the kind of structure that one would expect as something that has shown you vascularity in a tumor. This one here looks not unlike this one here. And again, the curve looks somewhat like what you'd expect to have for a V-type thing.
it's difficult to get equivalency here because they're not the same thing at all. But you can see that the ICA is clearly doing something physically meaningful here. It might actually be doing something better because we've got this component here, which is a continually rising one. So it could be that the ICA is able to account for the fact that we might have some edema, for example. This might be just water leaking out and accumulating, which our model-based method, because we haven't said anything about edema, can't possibly tell us. The problem with ICA is that it's very, very difficult to validate. So Hatef Marabian has been working with Rajiv's data. So this, again, is that tumor I showed you earlier. When you apply ICA to this tumor here, you can see that we start to separate out some quite interesting components. And Hatef will be talking this afternoon in the dynamic contrast, dynamic studies session, and he'll be talking about how we're trying to use this approach to validate the ICA method. And this just shows you very quickly that the intravascular MR image that he's got looks rather convincingly similar to the intravascular ultrasound image. These are actually quite exciting results. No one's really been able to validate ICA before in a meaningful sense for this sort of application. So validation remains a very big problem. It doesn't matter whether you're working in this area or on image registration or model fitting, we always got to get back to validation. We can do a certain amount with simulation studies, and for the registration stuff, we certainly use simulation studies to look at how well we can recover the deformations. But at the end of the day, we really need to know how well are we estimating something that's physiologically meaningful. So this is some other work we're doing in the lab. So this is the ICA method, for example. And ideally, what we want to do is go from the in vivo imaging, and then we want to go to the ex vivo. So this is a whole mount histopathology slide. This is the kind of data that Martin Yaffe at Sunnybrook has been able to acquire. This is taken of a whole section of breast tissue, quite a large section here. And this is the breast tumor here, and this is the zoomed in section. Ideally, what we want to be able to do is go from this to a pixel in this, so we can start to look for microvessel density and various other markers, biomarkers. So we want to go from the in vivo imaging to the in vitro imaging to the histology image so that we can go here. This is what we really want to do, but this is a deformable breast in vivo, and the surgeon is going to cut out a section of this tissue, is going to mount it, slice it, stain it, and then turn it into this. So really, this is an almost impossible task. What we have to do is we'd have to take the in vivo image, map it to the in vitro image, and this is work Marin will be doing in the future. And then we have to take the in vitro image and map it to a 3D histology image. And forming this 3D image here and this in vitro image is the subject of Roshin Shajai's PhD thesis in my lab. So what Roshin's doing is she's taking an in vivo MRI. She's then imaging the section after it's been excised and put in agar. So this is an MRI image in vitro. And then she's going to match it to a stack of histology slices. Now, the histology slices, the conventional way of stacking these is to do some kind of deformable registration to match this histology image to this one, to this one, to this one. But the problem is it's a bad problem because if the section is curved and you just use a registration thing based on these images, you're going to straighten out curved structures and so on. You've got no information about how these things should align in the Z direction. So what Roshin's doing instead is she's creating an intermediate thing of an optical block face. You take a photograph of the block before you create the slice. This is a solid paraffin-mounted block, so it's pretty rigid. And where this comes from is this is a microtome here. This block of tissue contains that little sample in there. It's like a meat slice. You basically slice down a very, very thin slice, and this is a whole bunch of slices coming off here. So what she does is she takes a photograph of this and then matches it to this once it's been stained. You can see that once it's here, this is microns thick, so this is actually subject to a lot of stretching and tearing and so on. So this is a photograph here. These markers are just being used for validation purposes. They won't form part of the final pipeline. So this will be the pipeline. So you go from in vivo to in vitro, you match the in vitro to the block face, and the block face to the histology. And that should give us everything in the same coordinate frame so we can finally get corresponding slices. And at the moment, Roshin's busy trying to validate the first try at this using those markers. And you can see here that it's in principle quite feasible to match up the block face and the histology. We haven't quite got to the in vivo yet. That's the next step. So the final thing on this graph here that I haven't really gone into is objective assessment of changes. Now, this is where future work is needed, and this is somewhat related to the final subject of the previous talk as well, is what do we do with all this information once we've got it? Conventionally, with assessment of therapeutic response, we draw regions of interest around our tumor. We estimate a K trans and a KEP value for that whole tumor, and then we just look to see if it's changed. That's very, very crude if we're dealing with an inhomogeneous tumor. We might have some areas that are responding, some areas that are not responding, and so on. So this is an example here. You can see this is a breast image before therapy, after therapy. This is a K-trans map before and after. First of all, see that the RECIST criteria would have been hopeless. The old way of doing it by measuring the axis of this wouldn't have told you there was any change really between those two images. In actual fact, there's been a huge change. This is neoadjuvant chemotherapy. This is when a woman with a large breast cancer is given chemotherapy before surgery to shrink the tumor. Now, if there's no response to that therapy, you don't want to keep giving them chemotherapy. You just want to move them straight into surgery. You don't want to wait 4 weeks while nothing's happening. This shows you here that the therapy is clearly having a major effect. This K-trans value is totally different. Now, we can see that by eye, but the question is, how do we quantify that? How do we give this to drug companies in numbers that they can throw into their stats package, show to the FDA that the drug is effective, and so on? We have various challenges. So image registration, for example, could map the pixels on here to the pixels on here. But image registration doesn't necessarily have any meaning in these cancer cases. We have bits of the cancer probably disappearing completely and being removed. We have deformations, we have edema, we have all sorts of changes, and it's not really clear what it means to register this image to this image. So perhaps what we need to do is somehow map in some sort of clustering technique, figure out, you know, maybe do a histogram of what K-trans values we have here compared to here. Maybe we need to form some kind of manifold where we look at all sorts of different parameters in this space and see where it goes to in this space and so on. So this is an area that hasn't really been looked at very much. This is certainly a rich area for further mathematical study, certainly. Okay, so hopefully that's given you some idea of some of the challenges in using DCMRI to assess therapeutic response. I'd just like to acknowledge all these people from my lab and various collaborators. As an image processor, I rely heavily on other people to acquire my image data, so these are all the good folk that give me data. And finally, I'd just like to make a plug for another meeting that's happening in Toronto, this time in September. Medical image computing, computer-assisted intervention will be held in Toronto this year. It's a large international conference, and I hope to see many of you down at Western Harbour for that. So thank you very much.